In continuing our exploration of the refuges, I'd like to start with a little bit of a sense of the refuges, the threefold refuge we've been talking about. We might think of it as three different things: refuge in Buddha, refuge in Dharma, refuge in Sangha. And yet, my understanding is that they are not so much three separate refuges, but three kind of intertwining strands of a single refuge. One way to, an analogy perhaps, as a way to understand this threefold refuge as three strands of a single refuge is the analogy of an illness and of a doctor who diagnoses an illness. This is like the Buddha being the understander, the person who has understood the illness of suffering and has some medicine for us. And so the doctor, when seeing a patient, evaluates the patient and determines, well, what is the illness? Describes the illness. And then with that wisdom and that knowledge and that understanding offers us a prescription, basically. What we can do, how we can become well. And so the prescription here is kind of like the Dharma, the teachings, the practices, the wisdom that the Buddha offers us. And we have to take the medicine. You know, the doctor can give us the prescription, but if we don't go to the pharmacy, fill the prescription and actually take the medicine, getting the prescription doesn't do us much good. And so we have to actually engage. We have to actually take action on that prescription. And so very like that, we have to take action on the prescription the Buddha offers us, the prescription of the Eightfold Path, the prescription of the Dharma. Engage with the teachings, he says. He says the Buddhas just point the way. They don't cure us. They just point the way. And so this is the refuge in the Buddha is like the refuge in the wisdom that the doctor offers us, the wisdom that the Buddha offers us, the person who can help us to identify what the problem is, what the illness is. And then the Dharma, the refuge in the Dharma, is the refuge in the possibility and the prescription for becoming well. And then refuge in Sangha, we can, if we are really ill, for instance, we may not be able to simply take the medicine. We may need attendance. We may need support. We may need people to help drive us to our appointments and to get our prescription or to support us, to help us get our meals while we are recovering. And so we have to have support of others in order to fulfill this prescription. And in very many ways, this is kind of an understanding of the refuge in the Sangha. The Sangha is the support to help us engage with this prescription, with this practice, with these teachings. Most of us need help in following this path. The Buddha, it is the understanding of the Buddha. The Buddha found the path for himself without somebody pointing it out to him directly. But most of us need help. Most of us won't find this path without a substantial amount of support. And so while all of this, all three of these aspects of the refuge, the Buddha, like the physician, the Dharma, like the medicine, the cure, and the Sangha, our support, we need all of them in order to be able to take the medicine, in order to be able to cure our illness, to understand our struggle, our suffering, our distress, which is what the Dharma points to. And so we can understand these three refuges not as three separate refuges, but as all supporting each other. And so the refuge in the Dharma, which is the basic kind of direction of this exploration today, is the emphasis of this part of the refuge is, it's twofold, it's kind of two-sided. It is, as I pointed to, it is the prescription. It is the wisdom that the Buddha offered us, the teachings, the practices, the instructions he offered us, is a part of refuge in the Dharma that we can't really become free. We can't become, release the struggle, the suffering, the greed, the aversion, the delusion, without some engagement with that, with those teachings. And so a part of the refuge in the Dharma is around basically taking refuge in our engagement, trusting the teachings to some extent that we want to engage. We have to hear the teachings first. We have to hear something about this prescription to decide for ourselves if this is something that feels like we want to step into. And yet we do have to step into it in order for it to have an effect. And so this is a piece of the refuge in the Dharma, this trusting the teachings enough that we're willing to step into the practices, into the teachings. And then as we engage, we begin to have a sense or an understanding for ourselves of the value of the teachings, because the teachings aren't simply about learning, check, I understand the Four Noble Truths, check, I understand dependent origination, all of these many lists that the Buddha offered. It's not like a checklist that we memorize them. It is an encouragement, the Dharma of the Buddha, the prescription that the Buddha offers us is a set of actions to take that help us to understand our own minds. And it is that understanding, as we begin to understand our own minds and see the patterns and habits and how suffering unfolds, how we struggle in that reactivity that Pam was talking about, the habitual movement from liking to wanting to greed, not liking, not wanting to aversion, that habitual pattern is catching us in suffering. And that as we begin to learn that, as we begin to see how that functions, how that works, the wisdom of the seeing of it begins to transform the mind. It's kind of a mysterious thing. Somebody today asked me a little bit about how letting go works. And, you know, the letting go that we consciously do when we see some kind of struggle or reactivity, when we say, oh, I'm just going to let go of that or put that aside, that's a kind of a temporary letting go. That's not the true letting go that leads to freedom. That is a kind of a stepping stone towards letting go. But the letting go that is referred to here is a letting go that comes because the mind understands this is not worth doing anymore. It's not that I have decided this isn't worth doing, but something deeper Something deeper understands that this engagement in greed, aversion, and confusion is not helpful. And it is through the engagement, through the meeting of the mind through these practices, that this wisdom begins to grow. And so this is another side of the refuge in the Dharma, is the wisdom that begins to develop, the wisdom that begins to understand directly something like anger is suffering. Anger is not helpful to this being. Anger has been, you know, all our forms of reactivity. You know, anger is just the one example here I'm calling up. Our forms of reactivity that are habitual, that we have engaged with, that have we have been trained in, essentially, through our culture, through our families, the reactive patterns have been developed and cultivated. And what we begin to see is that these reactive patterns have deluded us. They have kind of had, they have had us with a filter in front of our eyes, with a belief that somehow this reactive pattern is helping me, is creating the conditions that I will be happier. And there's some, you know, following through on liking and wanting and not liking and not wanting, there's a little measure of happiness that comes from that. A little tiny measure of happiness that comes from getting something that we want or getting rid of something that we don't want. And the Buddha pointed to, yes, that kind of happiness is there, but it is not the best kind of happiness. It is not the most profound possible kind of happiness that is available for us as human beings. And this, what we start to see as we engage with looking at our own minds, using this prescription to actually investigate our own minds and what's going on when we're struggling and suffering, then we start to see directly in the moment that something like anger hurts in the present moment. It is painful in the present moment. And we have been missing it because there's a delusion embedded in anger that is something like, yeah, if I get this thing fixed, if I get rid of this problem, if I get make this person go away, if I fix this thing, then I'll be happy. And so our mind has kind of leapt forward into the kind of imagination of, well, when I get rid of that thing, when that thing is fixed or changed, or I convince that person of this thing or whatever the reactivity is about, when I've done that, then I will be happy. And we miss in that whole kind of habitual way of being with our reactive patterns, we miss that we are suffering right now. That reactive pattern has just completely obscured that right in this moment, the experience of the arising of that reactivity, the experience of the arising of that anger is painful right now. And so we start to see that. When our mind, so through this practice, starts to see these things, starts to see that the reactivity that we are engaged in is painful, this is where wisdom develops. And this is the wisdom of the truth of the Buddhist teachings, that we start to see, oh yeah, this is greed, aversion, and delusion are not so helpful. And we experience some measure of understanding that for ourselves. And the mind, in understanding it, begins to recalibrate. It's like what's happening while we are using this prescription that the Buddha offers us, this Dharma prescription, is that our minds are getting a new education about what's going on in there. They're getting to see things that we haven't actually seen before. And so we see our struggles, we see our suffering, And one of the deep wisdoms of the Buddha, the deep truths that he offered us here, is that the wisdom is developed as we come in contact with suffering, as we get in touch with suffering, as we meet it, not with our habitual way of meeting suffering, but with this mindfulness, this opening to, oh, this is the human experience of reactivity. This is the human experience of anger, of frustration, of impatience. This exploration of seeing experience as just an experience in the present moment, and recognizing that this is conditioned. This is kind of the natural unfolding based on how we've been trained, how our culture has encouraged us to engage with certain things in certain ways. And so it's a natural unfolding that we have these reactive patterns and have this delusion. And so this shifting to, instead of the kind of habitual exploration of, well, when I'm angry, you know, what do I need to do to fix this or get rid of this or change this, our kind of habitual relationship to that kind of reactivity. It's more, oh, what is this experience? This is a very simple kind of definition of right mindfulness, of mindfulness, that we just get curious about what is this experience. And so this is the prescription the Buddha offers us. Get curious about your experience. And I'll also add something along the lines of, and the heart begins to stretch to be able to hold the suffering of all of that reactive patterning, all of that conditioning that we have been living with. And so we start to watch it and see it. The mind begins to understand something new about it. It understands that it is suffering. And because it understands, fundamentally here, the mind will understand its own participation in this show of suffering, that the reactivity that is actually a big part of why we are feeling in pain and struggling and suffering, that the reactivity itself, when we look at it, we see, wow, it hurts to be angry. It hurts to be frustrated or confused. It's not a place of well-being in the heart. And as we start to see that, the mind understands that that very reactivity is a construction of itself. We think sometimes that our reactivity is kind of created because of what other people are doing or situations in the world. And we kind of feel like buffeted around, like helpless, hapless things blowing around in the wind. And the Buddha says, actually, you know, it's not that way. That reactivity, it feels like, you know, it feels like we have these buttons all over us, and that all people have to do is come and push a button, and then we go, ah! But people really can't push those buttons in and of themselves. It's kind of like we have to say, hey, here's this button. Will you push it? And then we will react. So those reactivities that we are experiencing that have been conditioned in us are optional. They are not necessary. And this is really good news, actually, that the suffering that we experience, what the suffering that the Buddha said we could be free of, is the suffering that our own minds adds to our experience. And this is the optional piece. All of that reactivity, all of those pieces based in greed, aversion, delusion. And so as the mind starts to see its own contribution to its suffering, it begins to recalibrate. And this is the letting go that starts to happen. That recalibration, the mind begins to let go. We don't actually have to try to let go when this wisdom of the Dharma begins to be more directly understood through experience, through engaging in the practice. And so our practice in some ways is kind of a weaving between, can we trust this prescription? Are we willing to engage in this prescription? Are we willing to pick it up and try it on? Look at our own minds, meet the suffering. This takes courage, actually, this action of engaging with this prescription. Are we willing to do that? And then as we do that, as we engage with that prescription, we begin to taste and get a flavor of some of the shifts. Pam was talking about last night, shifts of perspective that happen as we start to look in our own minds, releases, different perspectives on a situation, these shifts that happen as we practice, then kind of give us the confidence that, yeah, this is useful. Engaging in this prescription is helpful. And so it's this weaving. We have this confidence, a little bit of confidence that's willing to step into this prescription, into this path. And then doing that, we get some feedback. We get some direct response of seeing with wisdom and some release, some shifts that give us even more confidence to engage at a deeper level. And so this weaving between this trust in what the Buddha is offering as his prescription, the Dharma, trusting that and engaging, seeing something directly for ourselves and trusting even more deeply and engaging even more deeply. And so it's this weaving between trust and wisdom. Trust and wisdom, our path. And so initially, we need some kind of trust in the teachings themselves. So this is the trust in the prescription. It's the physician giving us the prescription and saying, this is going to help. We might want to get some more information about it. You know, we might want to do some research about that prescription. What are the side effects? You know, how does it work? And does it feel like, okay, when can I take it? And we might want to do some research about it. And so this is the beginning. You know, we might want to, in hearing the teachings of the Buddha, think about them a little bit, reflect on it. Does it make sense to me? Do I want to engage? Am I willing to engage? Am I willing to step into this path? For myself, this was an interesting process in my own journey. This stepping in, this willingness, seeing, am I willing to trust these teachings? Because as I heard about the teachings, I mean, about all I understood when I first read a book about the Dharma was something along the lines of, well, it's really useful if instead of acting on your reactivity, you pay attention to it. And I thought, you know, this was a whole book I read, and that was what I got out of it. And I, like, had no clue how that would work. I thought, won't that just make me more reactive? To look at my reactivity. And yet, what happened for me at that moment was my friend had sent me this book. So a couple pieces. I had my friend sent me this book and she had said, hey, this book's really helped me. It's like, okay, somebody said it's been useful. Somebody I trust, somebody I know says this has been useful. And then the other thing that was going on in my mind is nothing anybody else has said has been useful in terms of dealing with my struggle and my suffering. I felt like I'd hit bottom. I had tried everything that everybody had said, oh, do this, do that. I had tried everything. And I was so miserable. And so I had kind of like hit bottom. And so basically, I was willing to try anything. So that was good for me because very quickly, actually, so this was my own kind of initial step of faith. I did not understand how this could possibly work. But a friend told me it was useful and nothing else had worked. So I was willing to give it a try. So stepping in. So the first part of it was hearing something of the teachings. The second part was the willingness to turn towards my experience. And so that was the first thing to do. It's like, okay, when that comes up, that reactivity comes up, I said that I was going to be aware of that. So, okay, here I am. That's what's happening. And boy, does it feel miserable. Again, I didn't quite understand how it was working. But over the next few weeks, what I began to see, it didn't actually take that long to get a little bit of very clear, verified feedback that this was helpful. Because in the initial experience when I was basically so reactive that the mind would get caught into a reactive loop and I would get frozen. I would find myself just frozen in front of my computer, enraged and not able to function. And what I saw over the course of a few weeks was that that level of rage was diminishing. I wasn't getting caught in that level of rage at all anymore. Yes, I was getting angry, but it was at a much lower level. And I could kind of, oh, there's that anger. Wow, that doesn't feel good. I don't know what to do with it. Okay, maybe I go back to work. That's kind of how I worked with it in the first little while. And so this was an engagement, a trusting enough to take action based on this prescription that my friend sent me the book, my prescription, here's what you do. And I was willing to engage. And very quickly, within the first couple of weeks, I got some feedback. This is helpful. This is helpful. And so we begin by hearing the teachings and begin to engage. And we get, are we willing to run the experiment? You're all here. You are all willing to run the experiment. And so as we start to use this prescription, we do start to see wisdom. You know, we start to have some more clarity, the settling of the mind that we've talked about. This comes some with concentration. The mind, through the practices of being present with our experience, the mind gets more collected. It's not so pulled out into our reactivity because it's more present. And so that kind of concentration, that the mind that has some stability, helps us to see our reactivity a little bit more and also to have less of it. And so that's one way that the practice helps. The concentration helps to deepen our trust in the practice because we see, well, first of all, the concentration is it's a kind of a different kind of happiness in a way. You know, the flavor of the mind as it settles gets a little more stable, is not pulled out into thoughts and reactivity. That feels pretty good. I think you've all had a little taste, at least from time to time, of that mind that is more collected, more settled. It feels good. It's a different kind of feeling good than getting something that I want. And so we get a little taste of that different kind of happiness, a little taste of a different kind of happiness. This is not the deepest kind of happiness even that the Buddha pointed to. And so that the trust in the practice develops as we see the mind can settle and collect. That there are these practices help the mind to settle and collect. And then another side of the trust develops more with the wisdom, the understanding, the insight, as we start to see wisdom at work, as we see looking at our own minds, we start to see these shifts, the kind of shifts that Pam was talking about. A little shift around some kind of reactivity. You know, we might feel a little shift of perspective around something difficult. And it might be as simple as kind of when a reactive habit or state of mind is arising, we notice or see, oh, this is just the human experience of frustration. As opposed to being frustrated, we know it as an experience. Oh, this is what it's like to be a human being that's frustrated. And so there's a little shift there. Often it's felt as a little space around the experience. We don't feel quite so like buried in the midst of it. We know, oh, this is frustration that's happening. Instead of like believing the frustration and acting on the frustration, buying into the frustration, we are aware, oh, this is what frustration is like. That doesn't sound like much, maybe, but when you experience that shift, it's palpable. You know that shift. And that shift is an indication that wisdom is at work in your mind. It is seeing something in a different way. And so the shift might just be that simple. Oh, this is just frustration arising. Oh, this is a pain in the knee and anxiety about that pain. That's what's happening. That we see it as a human experience, as something that's happening in the present moment. This is wisdom at work in the mind. And we feel the difference. We know the difference. Sometimes the wisdom, as we explore our patterns, our habits, sometimes the wisdom gets strong. And when we see something arising in the moment, or there's curiosity or turning towards it, and a not non-resistance, like total non-resistance to it, sometimes what can happen there is that that pattern or habit just seems to like go poof, it vanishes, it just this is a kind of maybe a slightly stronger wisdom at work in that moment. The first time I really felt this thing, this kind of wisdom that let the awareness of something vanish, I thought I'd done something wrong. So I was noticing that I was feeling abandoned. I was in the midst of a long retreat. I was at a 3-month course, and it was halfway through the course, 6 weeks in, and they were switching all the teachers. And so I got different teachers in the second half, and I felt abandoned by my first teachers. I felt kind of anxiety about meeting the new teachers. And I was sitting there in between, in the days between, after my last teacher had left and before I met my new teacher, I was sitting there noticing the kind of the loneliness, the longing, the feeling of abandonment. So I was observing this all and kind of like feeling into it. I kind of felt like a four-year-old. That was an interesting little piece of the flavor there. And then at some point, the mind just got really interested. It's like, well, you know, what is this feeling of abandonment anyway? And it just kind of like tried to turn to look at that feeling of abandonment. And it wasn't there. It had vanished. It was like, where did it go? And I thought, I actually went and reported to my teacher, my new teacher. I said, okay, we have to work on how I like work with emotions because I don't know how to be with emotions. And she said, well, describe to me what happened. And I said, I described that. I described that when I turned to actually kind of be curious and look at the abandonment, it was gone. And so I said, obviously, you know, I was repressing it. And she said, well, was it your experience that it felt like it was repressed? I said, no, it just felt like it vanished. She said to me, as really affected me for a long time, she said, trust your experience. Trust your experience. This can happen. Wisdom can free the mind of its reactive patterns. And it was like a revelation to me. So that kind of shift can happen at times. And yet there are many, many times, I'd say, you know, those kinds of shifts where there's a release of something, kind of a going poof of something. You know, we might think that if I'm being mindful in a... I'm doing the practice properly, let's say. If I'm being mindful properly, then all of my reactivity will go poof. We might believe that. Well, I'm here to tell you that that is not the case. Occasionally, that does happen. In my experience, it's the rare occasion that that happens. Much more often, there is more this sense of kind of being able to hold something, of being able to, okay, yep, that's what's happening. Yep, there is reactivities happening in the present moment. Okay, yep, I'm with it. I can be with it. It much more has this very gradual kind of process. It's like we meet a pattern for a little while, a little piece of it. We might understand a little something, and we might not even consciously know what we understand, but we've hovered with something for a little while, and then it like fades for a little while, and then it comes back, and then it might fade, and then it comes back, and it comes back over and over again. And if we feel like it's our fault that that's happening, that's kind of piling a reactivity onto the pattern. Instead, what I finally learned to do is just like, okay, well, this is what's happening. Can I be with it? Can I meet it? Sometimes we can, sometimes we can't. Sometimes the patterns are really strong. They're almost overwhelming at times. Sometimes it feels like the conditioning, all of these patterns, all of these reactive patterns are a result of conditioning, of how we have been how we have been sculpted by our conditioning. And so all of these reactive patterns are conditioning. And the process of the cultivation of mindfulness, we're learning that. It's like, so those reactive patterns have been strong. They've got a lot of momentum. They've been practiced a lot. And here we are practicing mindfulness for a little while. I mean, even like, you know, the 20 some years I've been practicing mindfulness compared to the many, you know, 60 years I've been practicing the defilements, the reactive patterns, you know, it's just a fraction of that. And so the momentum of our reactivity can sometimes be stronger than our capacity to meet it with mindfulness. And so we have to honor that. We have to recognize that there are times that we can meet something with mindfulness and times when it's skillful to turn away, skillful to set it aside, skillful to say not now to that pattern and put our attention on something else. So sometimes it feels like the reactivity is like this huge wave and our mindfulness is like a little tiny stream, a little tiny trickle. It's just overwhelmed and swamped by that reactive pattern. And so when that happens, it's often not so helpful to try to be mindful at that point. If you just find yourself swept into that wave, then this is time to bring in some wisdom that says, maybe not now. Maybe not now. And so this is also, I mean, so the more gradual nature of the practice is recognizing when we have the capacity to be with some difficult experience, some reactive pattern, and when we don't have that capacity, and using some other tools, some other skills that help us to settle and balance the mind. So sometimes the wearing away of that momentum of the reactive patterns, those tsunami waves of reactivity, can be very gradual. And even sometimes in that setting aside and saying, yep, I see you, not now, I'm, you know, this setting aside, it's really helpful if this is done in a very respectful way. Because this pattern, this tsunami of reactivity is a part of your system. It's a part of your conditioning, of your life, of how you've been shaped. And it deserves to be respected, but not believed in, let's say. So in that respect, it's not trying to say, push it away, get rid of it, push it down, repress it. But more along the lines of, okay, yep, I see you. You know, you can stay in the room with me, but right now I am going to put my attention on something else. I'm going to like put my attention just on being in a body, sitting in this chair, feeling my feet on the ground, something really simple. And so sometimes that is the most skillful strategy when there's something very strong happening. And in my own experience, I have seen that there are times that successive time after time, seeing the strength of a pattern, the strength of a reactivity, and saying, yep, okay, I see you, not now. I see you, not now. That at times there has been the experience of a pattern kind of just weakening slowly, slowly, slowly over time. And actually vanishing, going away while I wasn't looking at it. So that setting aside, not with repression, but with honor and respect, when I did this with one pattern, as I said, I see you and I will get back to you, but not now. and so it kind of felt met, it seemed that pattern felt met in some way. And the what happened over the course of, this was a long time, couple years probably for this particular pattern. I began kind of recognizing that the bouts of that explosive anger got farther and farther apart. And then at one point, I remembered about those patterns of anger. That particular, the person that I was angry at came into my mind. And I remembered about that person and remembered about that whole pattern of anger. And the anger wasn't coming up. Even remembering that person, the anger wasn't coming up. And I was like, whoa, where did it go? I almost didn't trust that it had disappeared. But I couldn't even call it up in that moment. And it has not come back. And so it really disappeared. And I don't know when it disappeared. But this is another way that wisdom works in our system. This very gradual willingness to meet things over and over again. Not having an agenda over when it goes away. Or even digging in to figure it out. I mean, that was kind of what I figured I would have to do with this at some point. It's like, get to the bottom of it. You know, see, because I had seen at times how the pattern of anger, this one was like anger at a particular person, but there was so much anger in my system. And I could kind of see it was like, it had so deep roots. It was like to so many different parts of my upbringing and conditioning. And I kind of thought, wow, I'm going to have to get fully enlightened for this to go away. And the surprise was that so much of it could just like shrivel and die without actually getting to the bottom of it. It just weakened through not being, through being acknowledged, right? So it was not being repressed, and it was also not being expressed. So this very simple kind of just, okay, I see you, and wow, okay, little much right now, just be with something else. Very powerful. And much of the freedom that I have experienced has come in this much more gradual way. This slow wearing away of reactivity, this slow releasing. So much has been released that I have no idea in a way. I just mostly know in retrospect. You know, sometimes what we know in retrospect is, huh, that's not happening anymore. That is also a way that wisdom shows up for us. The Dharma shows up as the in a way, what happens over time is that the refuge in the Dharma shifts from, you know, taking refuge in something that feels like we're borrowing trust in, to the refuge in the truth that we understand for ourselves, the refuge in the shifts of perspective that we see this is valuable. And so the refuge shifts from being something like almost feeling external to us to feeling internal. Like we can trust our mindfulness. We can trust that we know what mindfulness is. And we know when that capacity to meet experience is trustable and when we need to step aside. And so this deepening of wisdom and trust and wisdom. They feed and fuel each other. And at a certain point, at certain times, and this seems to happen at various kind of stages in our path, in our practice. There's certain things that we come up to. Certain openings, a feeling of groundlessness, perhaps, or a feeling of just deep longing, or a feeling of emptiness. That takes a lot of trust to be willing and able to hold. The willing to let go of our habitual ways of navigating the world. Sometimes there's some part of us that goes, no, I can't, I don't know what I'm letting go into. I can't let go because it feels like I'll just be falling endlessly in this emptiness. How can I let go? I don't know what I'm letting go into. And at a certain point, the mind, and when that's that kind of sense is happening of, I don't know if I can let go, that's all that we need to know. Wow, don't know if I can let go. That's what's happening right now. We can't make the letting go happen. And at some point, the trust in this whole process deepens enough that we do have this sense of the mind is willing to let go because it trusts the direction that we have been headed in. It doesn't know where it's going, but it knows the direction is where it wants to go. And so that's the real deepening of the trust in this Dharma, that willingness to let go, even though we don't know what that means. Joseph Goldstein has a beautiful image of practice that kind of speaks to this entire talk that I've given. He talks about practice kind of having this flavor of skydiving. You know, you go up in a plane and got a parachute on your back, and you know, you're going up there and it's like, whoa, don't know. You know, so you're thinking about what's going to be happening. And so there's a lot of thoughts, a lot of perhaps reactivity going on. So that's a part of the practice, to be with that, the fear that comes up there as you're going up in the plane. And then you get up to your altitude and the instructor opens the door and says, okay, time to jump. And you stand at the door and go, I don't think so. And there's another level of reaction that needs to be looked at there. You know, the fear and the anxiety and the trust in the parachute, right? Do we trust the parachute? Finally, we decide we trust the parachute and we jump. And then the first little while, this is Joseph's description. I have not done skydiving, so... first little while, so he says, is kind of like, whoa, this is like really scary, this falling. But then you kind of land at this kind of, I guess there's a point at which you land at the velocity, right? There's at first you're falling and then you hit this terminal velocity, which means it almost feels like you're floating. It doesn't feel like you're falling anymore. And that's a kind of a place of pleasantness, of like, whoa, figured it out. Yes. This is good. Not holding on to the airplane, kind of navigating this like slipperiness of falling. Yep. Okay. And then you realize that you don't have your parachute on. And then another whole level of fear kicks up. And then there's all this like, whoa, you know, I'm going to die. Of course, you know, the whole kind of that piece of it. And then Joseph's final kind of piece about the letting go, this final letting go that I talked about, is a realization that there's no ground. That in this falling, there's no ground. And that is our life. And so it's a kind of a paradoxical image in a way. Can we let go into no ground? We say, you know, when we think about letting go, we think about, well, where am I going to land? And here, it's like, there's nowhere to land except in the truth of this infinite changing now. There's nowhere to land. It's all a changing, dynamic flux. And even hearing that might feel like, well, do I really want to do that? And so just noticing. You don't have to force yourself anywhere. What our path is the opening to what's here. And if that is the fear, if that is the anxiety, if that's the, whoa, don't want to jump out of the airplane, that's where we are. And that's what we know. And it too is just the conditioning arising, being known. And that's where, that's the honesty of the practice, is knowing where we actually are, not forcing ourselves to like push ourselves into a situation that we're not able to meet at this moment, but rather, what's this? What's here? And so this refuge, it's such an active process. We go for refuge. I think the initial piece of going for refuge is kind of about picking up the teachings, being willing to engage. But then the refuge becomes more established, and we have confidence in the teachings, confidence in our capacity to engage. And this unshakable confidence in the teachings is a very deep expression of trust in the Dharma. So let's just sit for a few moments.